From KUAZ News in Tucson, I'm Julie Burak, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Illiteracy continues to be a major problem in our community. Today, a report on what local volunteers are doing to help eradicate illiteracy. Some children in southern Arizona got a special surprise from Santa Claus this week. We'll have the story. An interview with a U of A student who's received the prestigious Marshall Scholarship. And Nelson Warnell has a feature story on the University of Arizona Arboretum. Plus, the commentary of cowboy poet and humorist Baxter Black. Those stories and more are coming up. But first, it's hard to imagine, but illiteracy continues to be a problem in our society. A recent study suggests that many people reach adulthood without the functional ability to read the most basic text. These individuals often get caught in a cycle of poverty that is passed on through generations. Luis Carrion explores the current state of efforts to eradicate illiteracy in our population.
The love of reading is something that we all like to imagine as an inherent part of our children's educational experience.
I'm Jim Murphy. I'm with the Rotary Club of Tucson, and I'm chairman of the Reading Seed Center board.
For Jim Murphy and others at the Rotary Reading Seed Coach Program, the objective is simple: to help all children in Pima County in the first, second, and third grades read at or above grade level.
What leads us into those kind of objectives is that from the first to the third grade, you learn to read, and then from the fourth grade on, you read to learn. And we know from statistics that if you can't read at grade level going into fourth grade, your chance of staying in school and be successful is diminished.
For many reasons, children often go through key periods of their lives with minimal exposure to books and reach the fourth grade with a learning deficit that is difficult to overcome.
I'm Alan Trachtenberg. I'm the director of the Reading Seed Program, and I've been involved with children's literacy for a little over 11 years since I first came here to Tucson and retired here 11 and a half years ago.
This is a terrific book here for the first graders.
We get to a child by finding out what it is that that child is interested in, whether it's volcanoes or dinosaurs or reading or cooking, and we will bring in materials to get that child excited about that. So we might have a book, for example, on dinosaurs. We might have two books. We might have a first grade book if the child's reading on first grade level on dinosaurs, and we might bring in a National Geographic article on dinosaurs, and we've had the child read to us from his book, and then we read to him from National Geographic. And what happens in the child's head is he says, "Gee, I'm reading from this book, but I really wish I could read from my from that book that you're reading from," and it excites him and motivates him to want to learn how to read better because that's really the material that he's excited about.
Good afternoon, Reading Seed.
The Reading Seed program is effective, and for the students that are lucky enough to have a reading coach, the odds that they will be successful in school are greatly increased. However, many children continue to fall through the cracks in the system and progressively lag behind in school.
I'm Betty Stauffer, and I'm the executive director of Literacy Volunteers of Tucson.
Literacy Volunteers of Tucson helps those that, for whatever reasons, have reached adulthood with substandard reading skills.
Literacy Volunteers has been here in Tucson for 45 years in one form or another, training tutors, volunteer tutors, to work with adults who are either trying to increase their basic literacy skills, reading and writing, or their English language acquisition skills because English isn't their first language.
An assessment of literacy among American adults, sponsored by the National Center for Education Statistics, suggests that the problem of illiteracy is much greater than people might suspect.
About 43% of adults in the United States are either at the basic or below basic literacy level, which means they struggle to read a newspaper article and pull two facts out of it. More shocking to me is the study showed that only 13% of adults in the United States are proficiently literate. And by that they mean that you can read two articles or an article in a chart or graph and be able to then extrapolate and analyze what you've read and how they correlate. I find that shocking.
Until recently, the efforts of adult literacy volunteers was funded in part by the state.
And then when Prop 300 was put on the ballot, that kind of was the last straw. Our mission statement says that we're here to help any and all adults who have the desire to learn. We don't want to become Border Patrol agents and have all of our students verifying for us where they come from or who they are. We just want to help adults learn, period.
It's difficult for many of us to imagine, but illiteracy continues to be a problem in our society. And although the task seems daunting, there are many that find a calling in trying to eradicate the cycle of illiteracy that traps so many people.
90% of the adult's brain is formed by the time the child is 3 years old. So you need all those synapses in the brain going. And you want the synapses to be recognizing the concept of reading. You want them to be building vocabulary, the concept of looking at words. Even though they do not know how to read at this point, they're becoming familiar with the concept of words on pages and the pages telling stories.
It's really part of a livable community. It's part of economic development. It's, you know, hoping that when the kids get to high school and get out, they're able to read and they're able to get good jobs.
That lack of education is one of the root causes of homelessness. It's one of the root causes of drug use. It's one of the root causes of criminal activity. So many of the social problems in this country that we sort of are so perplexed as to how to solve. When people have education and options, they're far more likely to have productive, successful lives than when they don't have the education. They then really don't have very many options either.
Okay.
The next person.
Okay.
For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Luis Carrion.
Stay tuned to Arizona Spotlight when we continue an interview with the latest recipient of the prestigious Marshall Scholarship. You're listening to Arizona Spotlight on KUAZ. For the second year in a row, a University of Arizona student has been awarded the prestigious Marshall Scholarship. The award was established by the British government in 1953 as a gesture of thanks to the people of the United States for the assistance received after the Second World War under the Marshall Plan. Since the program's inception, more than 1,500 young Americans have become Marshall Scholars. 21-year-old Matt Stone is one of them. He's a senior at the U of A, double majoring in International Studies and Economics with a minor in Philosophy. He'll graduate in May of 2007. He joins me now in our studios. Matt, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you very much.
Well, first, congratulations.
Thank you.
On the scholarship. I'm sure you're very, very excited about that. When did you get the news?
I actually found out the news about 4 weeks ago. It was actually the day of my interview in Los Angeles. I was still in my suit and tie from the interview, sitting at LAX, and I got a phone call from the British consulate. I was stoked. I mean, it's such a huge honor. Immediately called my family and friends and my professors, some of my professors here at the U of A. It's huge. I couldn't believe it.
And tell me a little bit about why you applied for the Marshall Scholarship.
Really, what I was interested in is energy security is my field of interest. And there are some exceptional programs in the United Kingdom. The Marshall Scholarship is designed for approximately 40 American students to go to the United Kingdom for 2 years to do graduate study. And really, the best programs for me could be found there. And therefore, I was very much interested in applying for this scholarship, although it is incredibly difficult to receive. And every year, just intense competition. So I was just hugely honored to have this opportunity in the programs there. I'm looking very much forward to.
During the application process, you had to write an essay. Can mm-hmm. you tell me a little bit about what you wrote in that essay?
Yeah, my personal statement was actually about my grandfather. He was a World War II veteran. He worked for a variety of different engineering firms. He moved his family around to Libya and Venezuela during my father's childhood. And overall, just one of the just most amazing heroes in my life, figures in my life. And I wrote my essay kind of as a testament to his spirit. He's unfortunately at this point, he has Alzheimer's. He's living in a nursing home. And I really was, to some extent, inspired. I went to visit him right before I started writing my essay. And I was just like, you know, I really feel like in my work in terms of energy security, I'm kind of picking up where he left off. He was a professor, an engineering professor at the U of A for a number of years. I mean, he was also very much worked for Bechtel and nuclear engineering companies and oil companies. And I felt that I was somewhat carrying on his work in a different way, and I wanted to try to draw that parallel in my essay.
Well, what a fabulous story. So what is it about energy security that interests you so much?
Well, I think, you know, when you want to understand international relations and geopolitics, you have to understand energy markets and how that works. I mean, there's a lot of cliched talk about, you know, the United States is too dependent on foreign sources of oil, Saudi Arabia, the Middle East and such. But there are so many other folds into that, in that field. For instance, in the developing world, in sub-Saharan Africa, when the price of oil is at $60 to $70 per barrel, what does that do to the people in the developing world who have to go out and buy kerosene to power their portable generators just to get a little electricity so that their sons and daughters can study at night when there's no light? Really, it's not just a geopolitical imperative for the United States to get off foreign dependence on oil and to move into alternative sources of energy. It's also a moral imperative because the developing world is being hurt by United States demand for oil. And I really want to understand the economics of the oil sector, which happens to be the predominant energy resource, and how we can move into other areas, into natural gas, into nuclear, into solar and wind and renewable sources of energy, ethanol. That's really what I want to get at. I want to understand the geopolitical ramifications of that, because one cannot understand how the world works unless one understands how these different countries and companies operate within a kind of an energy market.
And therefore, you're double majoring in international studies and economics.
Yes, correct. And this is an area of interest that didn't really hit me until about a year and a half ago. It was the summer of 2005. I was in Washington, D.C., interning for a nuclear threat initiative, which was a rather random internship, just kind of came out of nowhere, and I was very blessed to have that. Nuclear Threat Initiative is a nonprofit founded by Ted Turner and former Senator Sam Nunn to prevent the threat of nuclear terrorism and securing loose nuclear supplies. And that's where I realized that there is a major intersection between energy and international security. And I started thinking, well, what about the oil side? Well, not the nuclear side, but oil, natural gas side. And that's where I became very interested. And then this past year, I lived in Russia in my junior year, and I realized how important hydrocarbons were to the Russian economy. And that's when I became very much entranced by this idea that the world really has a huge component of the world system is energy markets. And that's where I wanted to really kind of develop my focus in graduate school.
So where will you be studying over in the UK?
Come next fall, I will be doing a year at the University of Dundee in Scotland. I'm doing a master's in energy economics. It's a one-year master's program. And then my second year on the Marshall Scholarship, I will be at King's College London doing a master's in intelligence international security.
Ultimately, when you graduate, when you're finished with the Marshall Scholarship, what are your goals? What do you hope to do?
You know, that's a very good question. I would like to see myself in policy, public policy making, foreign policy work in Washington, D.C., or New York, or London, or Moscow. I'd like to see the United States take on more of a burden in terms in the world community in terms of really achieving energy independence, not just for ourselves, but for the world as a whole. We really need to move in a way that we're not all dependent upon oil, which has an incredible environmental destructive effects and also has geopolitically destructive effects. And the United States really has a moral responsibility at this point. We need to bring China and India into that fold as well. I would like to be in the United States in Washington, D.C., when you have these kind of confluence of events that occurs. You know, that could occur in government, it could occur in think tank work, it could occur in academia or the private sector. Where exactly, I don't know, but I would like to be in one of the quote-unquote world capitals when these events merge together.
Well, Matt, I'm really impressed with you. Well, you're 21 years old. And I asked this question of Ajit Devakaruni last year when he won the Marshall Scholarship. Do you think of yourself as gifted, or do you attribute these achievements, these academic achievements, to just hard work and motivation? Because you don't speak like the normal 21-year-old.
You know, it's funny, as I was at a party a couple weekends ago and I started talking about some of this stuff to a friend of mine, and a couple of my friends who may have been slightly inebriated got really mad at me for talking about this stuff. But I think, you know, I work hard. I think it's kind of a hunger to understand how things work. I think we all have it in us. I just wanted to figure some things out, and I was inspired by my professors and some of the work I'd done here at U of A in classes, and I wanted to really reach out and go farther than that. It may be ambition, it may be drive. I think it's the willingness to work hard, and I don't think anybody couldn't do what I'm doing. I think everybody could do what I'm doing.
Well, Matt Stone, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much. I appreciate this opportunity.
When we continue with Arizona Spotlight, Nelson Wornell tells us about the University of Arizona Arboretum. This is Arizona Spotlight on KUAZ. The University of Arizona holds a unique collection of plants from arid and semi-arid climates around the globe. Many of the trees on the UA campus are the largest specimens in the state, and as Nelson Wornell reports, the trees are links to the university's past.
There are more than 7,000 trees on the campus of the University of Arizona, and U of A students are currently taking inventory of the collection. Elizabeth Davison is the director of the University of Arizona Arboretum.
Trees were planted on campus from the very beginning and mostly on the western side. I think a lot of that was to cut down on the dust and bring some shade in the afternoons. And some of the earliest trees were the olives that were planted in the 1890s along the western side of campus. And we have some information now that tells where they came from, even the nursery they came from in Santa Barbara. But the Campus Arboretum has been trying to document the sources of most of our trees, to do an inventory on all the trees that we do have, and to tell the stories, if there are any interesting stories, of a lot of the unique trees that are on the campus. We have 7,000 trees, but 400 different species, and many of them are just one of a kind.
Davison says monitoring the U of A Arboretum is not unlike a process that would be done at any museum.
Tagging the trees one by one is just part of inventory control. When you're a museum or a collection, you have to give every item that you have a discrete number. It's called an accession number. And we had an accession number for every tree in the database, but the groundspeople and the campus visitors didn't really know anything about these numbers. And so it's one way for somebody out on the grounds to say, I pruned tree number 300 today, or we had to remove tree number 500. Or someone can call and say, tree number 210 is outside my window and I don't know the name of it. Can you tell me what it is? And so this is just another way of collections management.
Janan Afalakawi is a native of Kuwait and one of the University of Arizona students involved in the mapping and tagging project.
Each time I come into work, I get a bag that contains some wires, some numbered tags, nails, and a map. And right now we're going to head out and tag a tree. We found our quercus, and now we're going to be tagging it. Well, right now I'll be inserting the nail a bit. A little high so no one can get it, and then I'm wrapping the tag around it, and now I'm securing it, and now I'm going to be hammering the nail through. And there you have it.
Davison says the data that has been compiled so far is being analyzed at the Arboretum headquarters in Herring Hall at the University of Arizona.
This is a large map of the entire campus, and along with all the buildings and streets, we see many, many, many dots. Each dot is an individual tree. Each tree has an individual name. It's in a relational database. We know the name of the tree, the number of the tree, and where it comes from, its Latin name, and in many, many cases, we know who planted it or who donated it.
The public is being invited to follow the progress of the inventory project online.
This is a map that's on our Campus Arboretum website, and the web address is just arboretum.arizona.edu. And when you click on Maps and Walks, then what you see is a sort of a smooshed map of the Arboretum, and you can enlarge it, and then it can show you all the trees. And so I can click here on information, then I can put the cursor on one particular dot, and it will show me the name of the tree, the number of the tree, where it came from, and anything interesting about it.
Davison says the campus tree monitoring project could yield long-range benefits to the University of Arizona.
We could potentially give a dollar value to these trees on campus, and we certainly know that they absorb stormwater, they clean the air, they give shade, they reduce cooling costs, and they improve the quality of life.
That website, once again, is arboretum.arizona.edu. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Nelson Warnell.
Up next on Arizona Spotlight, a report on Santa Claus's special visit to Tucson this week to surprise boys and girls at area schools. This is Arizona Spotlight on KUAZ. This week, Old St. Nick made an early appearance here in the Old Pueblo. Elves at the Volunteer Center of Southern Arizona teamed up with local law enforcement and Santa himself to spread some holiday cheer. Christopher Conover reports.
When out on the lawn arose such a clatter, the children at Los Amigos Elementary School sprang from their classrooms to see what was the matter. A sleigh drawn by 8 tiny reindeer didn't appear. Instead, it was a Tucson police helicopter bearing the same man immortalized in "Twas the Night Before Christmas," St. Nicholas. For 11 years, the Volunteer Center of Southern Arizona, along with local police officers, have helped St. Nicholas make his rounds. Ellen Hargis, the president of the Volunteer Center, says it's a heartwarming tradition.
It's absolutely magical. St. Nicholas arrives by helicopter. The children get to see him. He provides a gold chocolate coin to each child because that's part of the legend of St. Nicholas that the schools have been teaching the children. And then they walk in their classrooms and find their backpacks on their desks, and it is so much fun to see them. It's just a wonderful, wonderful day.
Can St. Nicholas leave you something?
Yeah.
The visit from St. Nicholas coincides with a worldwide St. Nicholas visit, and that is why the Volunteer Center elves fill backpacks with gifts for the children, according to the Volunteer Center's Hargis.
It's a visit from St. Nicholas because that happens every December 6th. It's celebrated as a children's holiday throughout the world, and we wanted to celebrate it here locally by being able to provide backpacks that are filled with toys and a book and a toothbrush for children in pre-kindergarten through second grade in 13 different schools here in the Pima County area. We're providing the backpacks to 3,800 children this year, so we're really excited that we can do that. We raise the funds and then we purchase it in bulk. There are several volunteer centers across the country that do it, and by doing that we get the power of buying in large numbers. And so we raise the dollars, and that way we can provide the same gift to each child, which is really important as well to us.
The new backpacks, which in this kindergarten classroom were waiting in the children's designated cubbies, form a rainbow of colors, and the smiles on the faces and the laughter tells the story. The schools on St. Nicholas's list are chosen for very specific reasons, according to Hargis.
We select the schools based on the percentage of children that are in the free lunch program, and for most of our schools that's well above the 95% number. And that way we know that the children that we're serving through this are children that quite often have no other holiday gifts. And even things like the toothbrush that's in the backpack, we have heard stories and recently got a letter from a principal talking about families that share one toothbrush. And so we want to be able to make sure that at least every child who gets a backpack has his or her own toothbrush. And also a book. We want to instill that love of reading because we know that's so successful to having a good education.
Yeah. After hundreds of hugs and some pictures, it was once again time for a modern version of Clement Clark Moore's famous poem. He sprang to his sleigh, to his team he gave a whistle, and away they all flew like the down of a thistle. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Christopher Conover.
And now here's Mark McLemore with the Arizona Spotlight Arts Calendar.
There are a lot of things going on this weekend for your holiday entertainment, including the Ballet Tucson production of The Nutcracker. It's this weekend at Centennial Hall. The Arizona Repertory Singers present holiday music with What Gladsome Tidings. For information on venues, call 792-8141. Holidays in the Old Pueblo is the show by the Reveille Tucson Gay Men's Chorus, happening at the Grace St. Paul's Episcopal Church this weekend. And at the Desert Museum Art Institute on La Cañada, the Southern Arizona Arts Guild holds the annual art show and sale called Holidazzle that runs until December 17th. For Arizona Spotlight, this is Mark McLemore.
Only 17 days until Christmas. Well, you might think it's a little early to start the countdown, but no doubt children throughout Southern Arizona are busy making their list for Santa Claus. But how do you answer those questions about Santa Claus? Or when? The following is a commentary by cowboy poet and humorist Baxter Black. It's called, Is There Really a Santa Claus?
Dad, is there really a Santa Claus?
Why do you ask?
Jason's brother said there isn't. He's in the sixth grade.
Well, what do you think?
I think there is, but how does he know what I want for Christmas?
Well, you write out a list and send it to him, don't you?
Yeah, but if every kid does it, how does he ever read them all?
Maybe the moms and dads help Santa get stuff.
Like if he runs out of Legos at the North Pole, they can just get him at Kmart?
Well, maybe that's how it works sometimes.
Or maybe he's just too busy to make them all himself.
Well, I do know moms and dads can tell Santa if boys and girls have been good, for goodness sakes, and have not been selfish and know the real meaning of Christmas.
I do, about Jesus being born and Mary and Joseph in the manger.
And how it's better to give than to receive.
I always put out cookies and milk for Santa. That's a gift.
Well, I think they mean it's more like giving to others.
To T.O. Bob and Aunt Tamara and all the cousins.
And other kids who aren't as lucky as you are.
Kind of like us being Santa's helpers.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it.
So how does he find everybody?
Well, he must have a map of the world or just know the way.
I'll bet the reindeer know the way just like Sonny and Coyote know the way home after we're done riding.
Or maybe Santa has a couple of good dogs who ride in the sleigh. They could help him get home, too.
Like Eddie and Poncho. So you think I'll get a Lego polar base for Christmas?
Well, I can't tell you for sure. Only Santa knows.
Are you gonna get what you want for Christmas?
Oh, I've already got it.
Dad, do you believe in Santa Claus?
Yep. If you're smart, you'll always believe in Santa Claus.
Arizona Spotlight is a production of KUAZ Radio from the University of Arizona and is produced in the KUAZ studios by Jim Blackwood with production assistance from Ginger Duran. Our executive producer is Peter Michaels. A portion of the music heard on today's program was written and performed by Calexico. Audio archives of Arizona Spotlight programs are available online at kuaz.org. Podcasts are also available. I'm Julie Burock.